The DC Palestinian Film and Art Festival is back in person for the first time in 6 years. There has never been a more critical time to honor stories created by Palestinians from historic Palestine and around the world. This year's festival featured the DC premiere of 6 films, including From Ground Zero, a collection of 22 short films made by Palestinian filmmakers in Gaza since October 7th, and it's Palestine's official submission to Academy Awards. The festival will also host a hands-on workshop to create your own political art, conversation with filmmakers and artists, and the DC book launch of Visualizing Palestine First Book. Details at dcpfaf.org. WPFW, building a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Hi, I'm Dr. Nick, and you are tuned to member-supported WPFW Washington.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
We were sitting here peacefully when suddenly we were struck. It shook the entire classroom and the rubble came crashing down on us.
Israel escalates its devastating siege and forced expulsion of Palestinians in northern Gaza with one of the deadliest single strikes, killing at least 87 people on Saturday alone. Survivors say the dead include many women and children. Israel's also escalated its attacks on Lebanon, including hitting bank branches around the country it says are supporting Hezbollah. Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu has vowed to strike back at Hezbollah and Iran after a drone struck his vacation home Saturday.
Prime Minister, how is it going?
Well, 2 days ago, we took out Yahya Sinwar, the terrorist mastermind whose goons beheaded our men, raped our women, burnt babies alive. We took him out, and we're continuing our battle with Iran's other terrorist proxies. We're going to win this war.
So will something deter you?
No.
We'll go to Beirut and Tehran for a response. Then Trump supporter, tech billionaire Elon Musk, is pledging to give away $1 million every day to voters who sign his super PAC petition in battleground states. Many say that's illegal. We'll speak with the Pulitzer Prize-winning New York Times investigative reporter Eric Lipton about his new piece, U.S. Agencies Fund and Fight with Elon Musk. A Trump presidency could give him power over them.
And so he is among the most complicated lights relative to the federal government of any single individual, really, the diversity of interactions he has. So the notion that this same person would then have a role as an arbiter of what is the appropriate federal regulations and what the appropriate spending is in these federal agencies, it's sort of hard to see how you could be both things.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The nightmare in Gaza is intensifying. Those are the words of a top UN official as Israel escalates its attacks amidst a devastating siege on northern Gaza. Health officials there say at least 87 Palestinians were killed in an Israeli airstrike on Beit Lahia on Saturday. Survivors say the dead include many women and children.
We were asleep around 12 a.m. when it suddenly felt like an earthquake hit the area. Debris was falling on us. We rushed outside after hearing screams of women and children and found that our neighbors had been targeted by massive bombs. Tons of explosives had fallen on a residential neighborhood full of civilians and displaced families. All those who were martyred here are children, women, and displaced people who fled from other areas due to heavy strikes, seeking shelter and what they believe to be a safer place.
Al Jazeera reports another 33 Palestinians have been killed so far today, including 18 in the Jabalia refugee camp. Israel's also targeting the last three hospitals in northern Gaza, the Indonesian, Al-Auda, and Kamel Adwan hospitals. Doctors Without Borders reports more than 350 patients are believed to be trapped inside the hospitals. Meanwhile, Israel's blocked six medical NGOs from entering Gaza. The groups include GLIA and the Palestinian American Medical Association. Israel also killed four water engineers who were traveling to make repairs to the water infrastructure near Khan Yunis. According to Oxfam, the engineers were traveling in a clearly marked vehicle when they were attacked. On Sunday, the Palestinian Authority denounced Israel's escalating attacks, saying in a statement, quote, genocide is unfolding in northern Gaza in its clearest form, in full view of the world, marked by siege, starvation, forced displacement, destruction of buildings, aerial bombardment, targeting of health centers, and mass killings, unquote. Earlier today, the Palestinian journalist Abu Bakr Abed reported Farah Al-Dhaloo has died in a hospital. She was the sister of 19-year-old Shaban Al-Dhaloo, who burned to death last week in an Israeli strike on Al-Aqsa Hospital. Visit democracynow.org to see our interview with Abu Bakr Abed on Friday. Israel's also escalated its assault on Lebanon by attacking nearly a dozen bank branches of Al-Qard Al-Hassan, a financial institution with ties to Hezbollah. Many of the banks were located in residential buildings and played a critical role in Lebanon's financial sector. On Sunday, the UN peacekeeping forces in Lebanon, UNIFIL, accused Israel of deliberately demolishing another UN observation tower in what UNIFIL described as a flagrant violation of international law. U.S. envoy Amos Hochstein is now in Beirut for talks with Lebanese officials over a possible diplomatic deal to end Israel's attacks. As part of any deal, Axios reports Israel's insisting it maintain the right to fly its warplanes over Lebanon and that Israeli troops be allowed to keep conducting operations in southern Lebanon. Hochstein's visit comes 2 days after a drone from Lebanon hit Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's vacation home in northern Israel. Netanyahu was not home at the time of the incident, which caused only superficial damage to his home. In a separate attack, Palestinian fighters in Gaza on Sunday killed the commander of the Israeli military's 401st Brigade, Colonel Hassan Daksa. He's been described as the highest-ranking Israeli army officer killed in Gaza over the past year. The Biden administration's launched a probe after highly classified U.S. intelligence documents were posted online, showing that Israel's taking steps to launch a retaliatory attack against Iran. One document came from the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency, the other from the National Security Agency. The documents reference recent drills involving air-launched ballistic missiles as well as covert drone activity. On Friday, President Biden was asked if he knew how and when Israel would attack Iran. Biden responded by saying yes and yes. The leaked documents also confirm Israel has nuclear weapons, a fact that has long been known but has never been acknowledged by Israel. Donald Trump has doubled down on his threats to deploy the National Guard or military to target domestic critics if he wins. Trump was asked about his threat by Howard Kurtz on Fox News.
You talk about the enemy within. There's enemies, America's enemies outside. The enemy within is a pretty ominous phrase if you're talking about other Americans.
I think it's accurate.
Questions continue to be raised about Trump's mental state after he held a rally in Pennsylvania, which he called Kamala Harris expletive vice president. Harris responded by saying Trump's personal attack was, quote, demeaning the office of president. Trump also made crude comments about the size of the late golf legend Arnold Palmer's genitalia. Palmer's family also criticized Trump's remarks. One of Palmer's daughters has said her father, who died in 2016, was appalled and disgusted by Trump's first presidential campaign. Peg Palmer said, quote, "What would my dad think of Donald Trump today? I think he'd cringe," she said. In other campaign news, legal experts are questioning billionaire Trump supporter Elon Musk's offer to give $1 million daily prize to registered voters in swing states who sign his super PAC petition. Pennsylvania Governor Josh Shapiro has described Musk's giveaway as deeply concerning. In Indonesia, Prabowo Subianto was sworn in as president on Sunday, 8 months after winning the presidential election. He's a former general who's been implicated in mass killings in East Timor, Papua, and Aceh, as well as the kidnapping and torture of activists in Jakarta. Prabowo is a longtime U.S. protege and the former son-in-law of former Indonesian dictator Suharto. Critics fear his rise to power could result in the return of military rule in Indonesia. In El Salvador, a court has acquitted and freed a group of environmental activists known as the Santa Marta Five. The five activists were instrumental in pressuring El Salvador to issue the world's first ever ban on metal mining in 2017. They were arrested in January of last year and accused of murder in what was widely denounced as political persecution. This is one of the Santa Marta Five, Saul Rivas, speaking after the ruling Friday.
We cannot be criminalizing and detaining people for something that happened in the past. When there was an investigation by the Truth Commission after the peace accords and the facts that could be considered as against humanity were cleared.
In Mexico, the Catholic priest, indigenous activist Marcelo Perez, was killed by two gunmen Sunday as he left Mass in the southern state of Chiapas. Perez was a member of the Tzotzil indigenous group, well known for his human rights activism on behalf of indigenous people and farm workers. This is a community member who'd worked with Marcelo Perez.
We have called on the government to clarify this case and bring justice to Father Marcelo, a great priest that always advocated for the poorest and for the people in need, that always listened and helped and now has been murdered. We demand all the government agencies to cooperate and give answers to clarify all this.
Tropical storm Oscar has slammed into Cuba after barreling through the Bahamas as a hurricane. Authorities warned of flash flooding, mudslides, and heavy winds as millions in Cuba are already grappling with a days-long power outage as its precarious electric grid continues to falter. Massachusetts Congressmember Jim McGovern called on the Biden administration to offer assistance to Cuba, posting on X, quote, U.S. policy has directly contributed to Cuba's energy problems by sanctioning ships carrying oil to Cuba and starving the country of foreign exchange earnings. In Mozambique, opposition presidential candidate Venancio Mondlane has called on his supporters to take to the streets in protest after a lawyer and an official with his Podemos party were shot dead in the capital Maputo. The lawyer, Elvino Diaz, was preparing to challenge the results of the October 9th election, although final results have not been announced. Early tallies show Daniel Chapo of the Frelimo party in the lead. Preliminary results show Moldova has narrowly voted to join the European Union. Near final results show just over 50% of voters supported joining the EU, a lower tally than expected. In a separate vote, Moldova's president failed to win a majority of votes, setting up a runoff on November 3rd. She's pushed for Moldova, a former Soviet republic, to move further away from Moscow's influence. She and others have accused pro-Russian groups of meddling and vote-buying ahead of Sunday's polls. In Australia, Indigenous Senator Lydia Thorpe was removed by force from a parliament event after she heckled King Charles following a speech to Australian lawmakers. Lydia Thorpe confronted the British royal as she walked towards him, decrying, "You are not our king." Other protests against King Charles' visit were held today. Australia's indigenous people never ceded sovereignty after their land was colonized by Britain and have never signed a treaty with the UK. And in Arizona, charges have been dropped against a deaf black man with cerebral palsy who was beaten and tasered by police officers in August after being falsely accused of stealing a cell phone. Newly released video of Tyron McAlpin's arrest showed officers violently confronting the deaf man who was unable to hear the officer's commands. He was then jailed for 24 days because he could not afford bail. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The nightmare in Gaza is intensifying. Those are the words of a top UN official as Israel escalates its war amidst a devastating siege and forced expulsion of Palestinians in northern Gaza. Health officials there say at least 87 people were killed in an Israeli airstrike on Beit Lahia on Saturday. Survivors said the dead include many women and children.
We were asleep around 12 a.m. when it suddenly felt like an earthquake hit the area. Debris was falling on us. We rushed outside after hearing screams of women and children and found that our neighbors had been targeted by massive bombs. Tons of explosives had fallen on a residential neighborhood full of civilians and displaced families. All those who were martyred here are children, women, and displaced people who fled from other areas due to heavy strikes, seeking shelter and what they believe to be a safer place.
Today, Al Jazeera reports at least 33 more Palestinians in Gaza were killed by Israeli attacks, including 18 in the Jabalia refugee camp alone. Palestinians have shared footage on social media that appears to show people in Jabalia being hit by a strike as they try to rescue an injured person in the street. Israel's also targeting the last three functioning hospitals in northern Gaza, the Indonesian Al Auda and Kamel Edwan hospitals. Doctors Without Borders reports more than 350 patients are believed to be trapped inside the hospitals. This is an urgent video call for help made Sunday by Dr. Marwan Sultan, director of the Indonesian hospital in northern Gaza.
Assalamu alaikum. I'm Dr. Marwan Sultan, director of the Indonesia Hospital. Since middle of the night, the Indonesia Hospital exposed to attack by the Israeli forces, and they attacked the second and third floor. Now we have 40 patients, 30 of them they are injured patients. There is some of the patients, they are very serious and they need oxygen and they need critical care. So the light electricity is off since midnight, and the medical staff, they cannot make the generator on because of the a lot of attack and a lot of danger. So we are calling you to make the medical staff and the hospital safe. Please, our brother and sister, or the humanitarian societies, urgent call, just to please help our medical staff and the injured people.
Dr. Marwan Sultan is the director of Indonesia Hospital in northern Gaza, speaking to us from there. Meanwhile, Israel's blocked six medical NGOs from entering Gaza. The groups include GLIA and the Palestinian American Medical Association. Israel also killed four water engineers who were traveling to make repairs to the water infrastructure near Khan Yunis. According to Oxfam, the engineers were traveling in a clearly marked vehicle when they were attacked. The destruction of the water system in Gaza has led to many diseases. On Sunday, the Palestinian Authority denounced Israel's escalating attacks, saying in a statement, quote, genocide is unfolding in northern Gaza in its clearest form, in full view of the world, marked by siege, starvation, forced displacement, destruction of buildings, aerial bombardment, targeting of health centers, and mass killings, unquote. Earlier today, the Palestinian journalist Abu Bakr Abed reported Farah al-Dalou had died of severe burns at a hospital just days after her 19-year-old brother, Shaban al-Dalou, burned to death last week in an Israeli strike on Al-Aqsa Hospital that led to a major fire that burned the displaced people encampment near the hospital. For more, we're joined by Dr. Ayaz Pathan, an emergency medicine doctor who returned from Gaza in August, spent time at the Indonesian and Nasser hospitals. Doctor, welcome to Democracy Now! Thank you so much for joining us. We just heard Dr. Sultan describing what's happening there at Indonesian Hospital. Can you tell us more, having spent time there and having direct contact with people continuing through to today?
Yeah, thank you for having me, Amy. You know, Dr. Sultan does an amazing job at this hospital. As a matter of fact, he was very clear about the fact that after the hospital was besieged, and from that besiegement, we could see all sorts of damage. I've spent weeks in that hospital. I've seen essentially every inch of that hospital, including the damaged floors from what happened late in 2023, the burned medical equipment, the drone fire attacks that we've seen. And one thing that he said is that he would invite the Israelis into that hospital anytime, any place to see what is going on, because there was no operations other than medical operations that were going on in that facility.
So if you can talk about the conditions and the number of women and children in this hospital, what the siege over the last weeks of northern Gaza means, and particularly in these three hospitals, you've spent time in one.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, what I found during my time there, and this is identical to the stories that you will hear from every healthcare worker that is both there or has traveled there, is that the types of patients you see essentially represent the population. And so when we talk about the Strip, we talk about a population which is about 50% children that are high school age or younger. And so everyone's experience is that you find a lot of children, you find a lot of women, and absolutely, are there men there? Completely. But in that age group that you would consider potentially enemy combatants, I would say that represented about 25, maybe 30% of the total injured population that I would see. And even that percentage I'm giving you is assuming that 100% of those males in that category are enemy combatants. So I think we're seeing a lot of collateral damage, far more than is acceptable by any stretch of the imagination.
And the effects, Dr. Pathan, of the whole area not being able to get humanitarian aid.
Yeah. So even when I was there, it was quite a challenge. Food insecurity was a huge issue. I was able to go to Kamal Adwan Hospital, which you had mentioned, and see their malnutrition clinic. I myself, who had privileged rights to food, lost about 13 pounds in about 2 weeks there. And now you can only imagine what people over months and months have had to deal with over there. And that's only the food issue. Now, talk about medications. There were times that I knew the exact medication I need to use, whether it was pain medication or an antibiotic, and unable to find that or use that, and realizing that in any other situation or country in the world, and quite honestly, even in the South, we had a little bit more access to some of these medications. It was tragic to watch people be in pain, die in pain, die of infections, which are completely preventable. And all in all, you're talking about Gaza, which has had about three dozen functional hospitals prior to all of this. That number has been taken down to essentially a third. And even the hospitals that we talk about, such as Indonesia Hospital, where I was in, half of that capacity was shut down due to damage from prior besiegement.
Dr. Pathan, we just have reports that Israel's killed four water engineers who were traveling to make repairs to the water infrastructure near Khan Yunis. According to Oxfam, they were traveling in a clearly marked vehicle when they were attacked. If you can talk, I mean, the horror of them being killed is horrifying enough. But the fact that they were trying to fix the water infrastructure, what that means, how devastated the infrastructure is leading to disease, including polio.
Yeah. Absolutely. I think water and the safety of the water is something that UNICEF has looked at. And I think on the order of 98% of the water that is available is not considered good for human consumption. So now you take an injured population, a sick population, even in the cases that are medical, for example, say pneumonia or something along those lines, the ability to be able to take care of these patients without something as simple as water, to be able to clean wounds, to be able to hydrate people, is a huge issue. I think the other point that you made is about just traveling. And so this is something we've seen time and time again, including my own experience, including experiences from other healthcare workers that have been there, and then other NGOs. World Central Kitchen, We've seen the United Nations World Food Program being targeted despite being in vehicles that have been given permission to travel and are clearly marked.
Well, Dr. Ayaz-Pathan, I want to thank you for being with us from North Carolina, emergency medicine doctor who returned from Gaza in August, spending time at the Indonesian hospital in northern Gaza and Nasser Hospital. When we come back, Israel's also escalated its attacks on Lebanon, including hitting bank branches all over the country. Stay with us.
Welcome to Democracy Now! If you're just joining us, and we of course are happy to have you in. Again, we are in our second week of our pledge drive. We're starting today, the second week, and it's another opportunity for you to support that which supports you. Our goal for this morning is $1,000, and folks, we can do that together. Again, we cannot emphasize enough how important it is to have the voices of those who are most deeply affected by what is happening in Palestine, which is the Palestinian people who are suffering now, right now, but also the doctors, the UNRWA workers that you've heard, the nurses, the journalists who are on the ground in Gaza, sending us information about what is happening so we can understand in a complete way what we need to do to move away from genocide and to move towards not only total ceasefire, but towards peace and security for everyone in that region and a state for the Palestinian people to inhabit peacefully and justly. So if you appreciate the reporting that Amy has done over all of these months and even before October 7th, since the inception of Democracy Now!, she has covered Palestinian liberation. And if you understand that their liberation, our liberation as people in this country are linked, and that the media at its best self, like Democracy Now!, is able to give you the tools to help make a difference on this issue, then we ask you to call and pledge your support. $1,000, we know for some in our community, is a very easy lift. You could do it. You could call right now and say, we want to pledge $1,000, and you won't even miss it. We know for others, $5 is a great deal. So we ask you to think about how much Democracy Now! Is worth to you, how much it's worth hearing it Monday through Friday, 8 to 9 a.m., when we roll it out live. And is it worth your dollars? It's worth your ears because you're listening. But we must make the connection to our dollars and support that which supports you. And if you've done well, to circle back to what I was just saying, and you want to do something great in the world, then please make that pledge of support. Give that $1,000, and we will be done with the goal this morning. Or give $5, $10, $15, whatever it is in your pocket that you can do. Some people can't afford to pledge it all, and we understand that, so we ask others who can afford to pledge, to step up. Again, the number to call, 800-222-9739 or 202-588-9739, or you can go online to WPFWFM.org, forgive me. Please make that call that makes a difference. You make everything here possible. Pledge for your neighbors that may not be able to afford to pledge right now, but vitally need this information. Do your part. Become an activist immediately. You might not be in the streets. You might not be able to lobby Congress or write a letter, but you can support that which supports you by picking up the phone, by clicking on the website, 800-222-9739. WPFWFM.org. Of course, we always have Cash App, $WPFWFM. Do what is in your heart, what is in your spirit to do right now to preserve this independent grassroots media outlet known as Democracy Now!, to preserve the voices of Palestinians and those serving and helping and working with Palestinians on the ground, those voices. Such important reporting right now. 800-222-9739. WPFWFM.org are the ways to connect with us. As we return to Democracy Now!, I am truly hoping I have a bunch of folks to thank, and we have made that $1,000 goal by the time we enter the segment after this one. So we'll return. You make that call, 202-588-9739 or WPFWFM.org, and we will reconvene on the other side.
But this is a clear violation of the Lebanese sovereignty. So either this proposal is a proposal to basically end the negotiations before they even start, or this is a proposal for Lebanon to surrender. I just remind you and everyone that the battle in the south is still ongoing. Hezbollah is still able to fight back and resist. The Israelis are not able yet to invade Lebanon as they probably would like to. The Hezbollah has still able to fire its rockets and drones to Israel. We've seen a week ago a drone has hit the Golani military base in Israel. 2 days ago, we saw that another drone hit directly the home of the sea home of Benjamin Netanyahu. And if this tells us anything, it tells us that Hezbollah is still able to operate in the south. And the battleground will definitely shape the negotiations as well. Yesterday, as you mentioned, Israel attacked directly and bombed financial institutions related directly to Hezbollah. Of course, we all know that Israel has identified any institution, civilian or not, directly affiliated with Hezbollah as a threat, and they're bombing it. Of course, this is only a way to demolish buildings in Lebanon and to further terrorize the Lebanese civilians.
And if you can talk about who uses this bank, do you agree that it's used to it's used for banking by Hezbollah, but also who else? And where are these banking branches located around Lebanon?
Yeah, I mean, these branches are located almost everywhere in Lebanon. In Beirut, mostly. These are banks that offer microcredits for the Lebanese. Of course, the majority of the constituency of Hezbollah benefit from these credits. Some people claim, and this is true, that there is no oversight over these financial institutions by the central Lebanese bank. But this is also an opportunity to remind everyone that private and commercial banks have escaped this accountability for years, and we have a collapsed banking sector now in Lebanon. So this is not...
Well, let me ask you another question, and it has to do right now with UNIFIL and what's happening with the UN forces in southern Lebanon, and also how that relates to the UN Resolution 1701. But they say another watchtower has been blown up by Israel. Israel wants them out. The significance of this, Professor Mawad.
Yeah, it's very shocking, actually, that Israel wants the Blue Helmets, the UNIFIL group, to withdraw from Lebanon because they want to basically invade Lebanon. And UNIFIL has been very defiant so far, and they said, we're not withdrawing from the south. They even went far and said that there is no way that only one member of the United Nations would dictate on us what to do. UNIFIL is in the south based on a UN resolution, and this shows how aggressive and immune it shows how Netanyahu benefits from impunity. We saw him directly attacking the UNIFIL. We saw him as well directly attacking the UN Secretary General Guterres and declaring him as a persona non grata in Israel. We saw him also attacking and directly shaming President Macron when President Macron mentioned the possibility of imposing an armed embargo on the Israelis in order not to go on with their genocide in Gaza. The day after, he shamed him and told him, shame on you for even thinking about this. So this shows how aggressive and lunatic Netanyahu is, and is willing to do everything in order for him to move on and implement his expansionist project.
Jamil, you have the U.S. envoy, Amos Hochstein, now in Beirut. You have Blinken headed to Israel. It's not clear where he'll be on his tour. It is his 11th trip in the last year to the area. And you have the Israeli foreign minister, Israel Katz, warning, we will keep striking the Iranian proxy until it collapses. Also, if you can talk about what Israel is demanding for a ceasefire. Axios reports Israel demands its Air Force has freedom of operation in Lebanese airspace, also demands, Israel demands, that the IDF be allowed to engage in active enforcement to attack Hezbollah. This would be part of the ceasefire that they say they would accept.
Yeah, as I mentioned earlier, in fact, this is a maximalist position by the Israelis. They don't want, clearly, they don't want a ceasefire. Clearly, they don't want to respect the UN Resolution 1701. I remind everyone that UN Resolution 1701 is very clear. As per this resolution, the Lebanese army should be deployed in the south, but it's also should be equipped in order for it to be able to defend Lebanon from potential aggressions. The Lebanese government also demands the demarcation of the borders with Israel. Till now, Israel does not recognize any borders with Lebanon except that for the blue line, which is a withdrawal line and not the borders. This shows that Israel is not serious about a potential ceasefire, but not only that, this poses question as to what the United States of America won't. Are they impartial when it comes to these negotiations? I remind everyone that Amos Hochstein was serving at the Israeli army. So is he impartial? Is he not? This is a question, this is a serious question. But so far, as we saw in Gaza on many occasions, the Americans are complicit in this genocide, and they're complicit in the war against Lebanon. And there is nothing that shows that they really want to impose a ceasefire on Lebanon. Not only that, they probably would like to, and this is what Amos Hochstein said, to protect the interest of the Israelis by him referring to the fact that the Lebanese government or the UNIFIL did not even enforce 1701 in the past, and he did not refer at all to the many violations of the Israelis when it comes to the 1701, specifically when it comes to the airspace violation of Lebanon during these 20 years.
Jamil Mouad is Assistant Professor of Politics and Policy at Department of Political Studies and Public Administration at the American University of Beirut, speaking to us from Beirut. The Biden administration has launched a probe after highly classified U.S. intelligence documents were posted online showing Israel's taking steps to launch a retaliatory attack on Iran. One document came from the National Geospatial Intelligence Agency, the other from the NSA, the National Security Agency. The documents reference recent Israeli drills involving air-launched ballistic missiles as well as covert drone activity. On Friday, President Biden was asked if he knew how and when Israel would attack Iran. Biden responded by saying yes and yes, unquote. Iran has issued a complaint with the UN's nuclear watchdog over Israeli threats to strike Iran's atomic energy sites in retaliation for a series of Iranian missiles that were fired into Israel earlier this month. Iran's foreign ministry issued a statement today saying, quote, threats to attack nuclear sites are against UN resolutions and are condemned, unquote. This comes as a drone hit Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's seaside home Saturday in the northern Israeli town of Caesarea. Netanyahu and his family were not home at the time of the incident, which caused superficial damage to his home. He shared this video on social media after the attack.
Prime Minister, how is it going?
Well, 2 days ago, we took out Yahya Sinwar, the terrorist mastermind whose goons beheaded our men, raped our women, burnt babies alive. We took him out, and we're continuing our battle with Iran's other terrorist proxies. We're going to win this war.
So will something deter you?
No.
That was Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu speaking to his aide. The prime minister also wrote on social media, quote, the attempt by Iran's proxy Hezbollah to assassinate me and my wife today was a grave mistake. I say to Iran and its proxies and its axis of evil, anyone who tries to harm Israel's citizens will pay a heavy price, Netanyahu said. From where we go to Tehran, to Iran, where we're joined by Hassan Ahmadiyen, assistant professor of West Asian and North African Studies at the University of Tehran. Professor, we welcome you to Democracy Now! If you can start off by responding to what Netanyahu said, blaming agents of Iran for the attack, though Iran disavowed responsibility for the attack on his seaside home. We may have lost Professor Ahmadiyen. I think he's coming back right now. Why don't we break, and we'll see if we can get back in touch with Professor Ahmadiyen, who is in Tehran, Iran. I think we have him. Professor Ahmadiyen, thank you for joining us. Can you respond to what Netanyahu said, that agents of Iran were responsible for the attack on his seaside home? If you can respond.
Yes. Well, I think Bibi Netanyahu has been trying to portray everything that's happening in Gaza and Lebanon around the region as part of Iran's act, whereas we all know it's a fact now that Iran didn't know about the 7th of October attack. And then its allies fighting Israel for their various national reasons, they are supported by Iran, but it doesn't mean that they act on behalf of Iran. But obviously, Bibi's eyeing another game. He wants to see a confrontation bigger than his surrounding. He wants the U.S., Iran to be dragged into a conflict, I think. That's why he's pointing always to Iran. In the beginning of his campaign on Gaza, he was focused on Gaza. And then when he wanted to widen the war, he started to point at Iran, and he started hitting Iranian targets. First came the Iranian consulate, then Iran retaliated. Then came the assassination in Tehran of Ismail Haniyeh in the inauguration day of a new president in Iran. Then Iran waited for a diplomatic settlement that Amos Hochstein and the Americans channeled to Iran that they are after, and they're using this assassination for a ceasefire there. The Iranians waited for 2 months only to be surprised by Netanyahu moving to Lebanon, assassinating, and the pager attack, the walkie-talkie attack, then the assassination of Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah. All of this came after Iran waited for a diplomatic settlement in Gaza. And then Iran decided that that's enough. We need to retaliate, otherwise our deterrence will be at stake. Obviously, to my understanding, but Netanyahu is inching closer to, you know, a confrontation with Iran. The Iranians have said time and time again that they will retaliate. They have been retaliating. Now he's talking about retaliating against Iran's retaliation, which is basically escalation ladder. He's on and he's trying to tell the world that it's Iran that is the provocateur. Whereas in Iran, everyone feels the way that Bibi Netanyahu is trying to frame Iran internationally. And as such, they are focusing on telling the world that we will not go for a war, we will not go for a confrontation, but if it's enforced upon us, we will have to retaliate. Otherwise, our deterrence will not work, and then it will be an open season in Tehran, maybe.
So, Professor, can you comment on these leaked U.S. documents, intelligence documents, describing satellite images of Israeli military preparations for a potential strike in Iran? You also have the foreign ministry coming out today in Tehran, speaking out and saying it would be illegal to attack nuclear plants in Iran, according to the United Nations. If you can comment on all of this, the intelligence documents, not clear how they were leaked, coming from, among other places, the NSA, the National Security Agency, the intelligence agency in the United States that's many times larger than the CIA.
You know, we still don't know what the intricacies of this leaks, but obviously, if they are intentional or not intentional, the leaking, it makes a difference. I mean, the messaging or the message of them being linked will be different. But in any case, I think the Iranians are saying that these leaks show that the Israelis are trying to attack, places of strategic importance that are legally, should not be attacked, but Israel is obviously trying or inching closer to attack them. It's within the Iranian, international or diplomatic reach, which the foreign minister and the president have been on the past few weeks, telling the world that we don't want escalation. But obviously, the Israelis are coming to force it upon us, and we will have to retaliate. The legality of the issue is obvious. I mean, it's illegal as per international law to attack. I mean, the Atomic Energy Agency. As charter, it's very obvious that it's not legal to attack such places. But I mean, the Israeli policy in assassinating scientists, killing a guest in an inauguration day in Iran, all the policies that have been pulled off previously were illegal as well. So the Iranians know that this is not going to affect the situation, but they are telling the world, these are the evidence. We're not after this escalation, but you should look at Israel and what it's doing to provoke Iran and its allies to retaliate.
Professor Ahmadian, can you talk very briefly about Iran-Saudi relations and how that plays into this? Iran's foreign minister, Abbas Araghchi, was in Riyadh earlier this month. And the fact that the 180 ballistic missiles that were shot into Israel killed one person, a Palestinian in Jericho, but these were 180 ballistic missiles. Is Iran actually coordinating this, sharing information with the United States?
I'm not sure that is the case, especially the second attack that Iran, rather retaliation that Iran did in October 1st. The first one was coordinated. Iran told the world and the United States and indirectly Israel as well that we are not We will attack in this timing. It was basically a political messaging that we can beat you, we can hit you, but we don't want escalation, so don't push us. The second attack, for October 1st, was a military nature. The Iranians showed their muscles, telling the Israelis, you're playing with fire, we can do this. Today, the message was that we can fire 7,000 missiles a day to deter Israel. But basically, the narrative is that we don't want escalation, but we are capable of fighting. When it comes to Saudi Arabia and the GCC in general, the Iranians are trying hard to keep them away from, basically assisting Israel, and also keep the warming up of the relationship between Iran and Saudi Arabia ongoing. The Iranians and the Saudis both have been pushing for a ceasefire in Gaza. The Saudis embarked on a diplomatic, campaign with the Europeans, with the Americans, for months now to stop the conflict in Gaza. The Iranians trying to push, saying that we don't want that the Israelis are widening the war and that this will be catastrophe to the. It was a political messaging campaign and also pushing back against Israeli provocation as the Iranians see them. Both have been basically met in the aim of stopping the Gaza war. And I think the relationship has been enhancing unexpectedly. Basically, the war in Gaza have brought Iran and Saudi Arabia, at least publicly and in the narrative, much closer than where we were before the October 7th. And both, as I said, they are aiming for the same target, that is the stop of the onslaught on Gaza and
Hassan Ahmadian, I want to thank you for being with us, Assistant Professor of West Asian and North African Studies at the University of Tehran, speaking to us from Tehran, Iran, previously associate with the Project on Shiism and Global Affairs at Harvard's Weatherhead Center for International Affairs. Coming up, Elon Musk pledges to give away $1 million a day to voters who sign his super PAC petition. We'll speak with New York Times investigative reporter Eric Lipton. He's got a new piece out on U.S. agencies funding and fighting with Elon Musk. A Trump presidency could give him power over them. Back in 20 seconds.
And good morning. We have some folks to thank for Democracy Now! Support. We want to thank Joseph in Silver Spring. Thank you so very much for your generous pledge of support. Anonymous out of Annandale, Virginia says, thank you for providing quality independent news, including the truth about what is happening in Gaza. And Anonymous out of DC, thank you so very much for your pledge of support as well. We still have a ways to go. You all have gotten us off to a brilliant start, but we still are in need of $765 to go to make this goal. We have 12 minutes to do it. We don't want to take up a lot of time talking because this information that Democracy Now! Is giving us is so very important, but so is ensuring that Democracy Now! Can be heard Monday through Friday, 8 to 9 a.m. So please, right now, $765 to go. Please go to the phones, make that call that makes the difference, 202-588-9739, or you can go online to WPFWFM.org. Freedom is not free, but with media outlets like WPFW, with programs like Democracy Now!, we all can get to liberation, to equity, to a beautiful world inhabited where all people are honored and respected. All people have their land. They have their space. And then we'd come together and we share space. This is what humanity should be about. This is the humanity that WPFW tries to promote. This is why we have Democracy Now! Here to help you calibrate how you'll move in the world to get to that beautiful vision that Dr. King called the beloved community. That's what we are. That's what we can be. We're not there yet, but that is what we can be if we pull together. And we have guideposts like the news and information and music you get on WPFW, like the news that we're getting right now on Democracy Now! So please go to the phones, 800-222-9739 or WPFWFM.org, $765 to go. We can do this together this morning, folks. I know we can. I know we can. Like the Pointer Sisters say, yeah, I know we can. So we're going to move back into Democracy Now!, 202-588-9739, 10 minutes to make the goal, WPFWFM.org. I want to thank you on the other side. Let's go.
Companies, SpaceX and Tesla, accounting for at least $15.4 billion in government contracts over the past decade. For more, we go to Washington, D.C., where we're joined by Eric Lipton, who co-authored the Times investigation headlined U.S. agencies fund and fight with Elon Musk. A Trump presidency could give him power over them. We welcome you to Democracy Now! Can you start off by responding to this promise that Elon Musk has made, $1 million a day to voters in battleground states who sign his super PAC petition, Eric?
I don't really know the legality of that proposal. I suspect, I have to imagine that there were lawyers that examined that before he made that proposal and that promise. But, you know, the fact of the matter is that's a trivial amount of money for Elon Musk. He's the richest person in the world. He's presumably the richest person in the history of the world. So that's a pretty small amount of to invest in this, in the final days of this election campaign. And he has, you know, literally billions of dollars at stake of his own business operations, both is in terms of contracts that he has with the federal government and, you know, millions of dollars at stake in terms of the many investigations that are ongoing of his company. So that's kind of like pocket change, relatively speaking.
Well, of course, the significance is it may be trivial for him, but for people who would receive it, that's the question. Is it a payoff?
Right.
But Eric.
Right. And I can't address the legality of that. That's up to lawyers and regulators to address.
So talk about this piece that you've just done. You're a winner of the Pulitzer Prize. This investigative report is quite remarkable. Lay out his empire and but most importantly also the contracts he gets from the U.S. government and what a Trump presidency is, of course, supporting Trump big time, would mean for him.
I don't think that it's reasonable to presume that he would get, you know, necessarily more contracting dollars if Trump were president. He is already incredibly popular because of SpaceX, almost exclusively, really, the bulk of it. And it's because his business has been so successful at transforming access to orbit and also communications from orbit. And so both with NASA and the Department of Defense, they're spending billions of dollars to buy services from him because he's delivering things that other companies aren't delivering. So on that side of the ledger, I think he's going to continue to see an increase in business with the federal government because of the services that SpaceX is providing. But the real question is on the investigative side, because Elon Musk is so determined to get things done, and ultimately his real goal is to get humans to Mars, that he often likes to kind of, you know, cut corners when it comes to regulations. He wants to bulldoze his way through. And so he has an incredible array of disagreements with federal agencies that oversee his operations, both from Tesla and from SpaceX. And so it's really all, you could go through the acronym soup of the United States government, and just about every major agency has some pending investigation, in many cases involving repeat offenses and, you know, multiple fines and or ongoing investigations. And so it's the thing that is most potentially problematic is if he is in fact going to be appointed by Trump to be the head of some efficiency committee that's going to examine federal regulators and the powers that they have and also examine their budgets. How is it possible that he could be simultaneously the subject of multiple investigations, the recipient of billions of dollars in contract, and the guy that's going to be deciding how to curb regulatory powers and how to reduce the expenditures for these agencies? It's just way too many roles that creates obvious potential or real conflicts of interest.
Let me ask you, last year alone, Elon Musk's company secured $3 billion in contracts from 17 federal agencies. Do you think we're talking about, to say the least, an over-dependence on Musk's companies, which are private companies? And talk more about, you know, Tesla, about SpaceX, and how it's intertwined with the government.
Yeah, the bulk of that money really is going to SpaceX. There's a relatively small amount that goes to Tesla. And most of that money, the biggest chunk of it, it goes for launch. And the Falcon 9 and Falcon Heavy, the two reliable rockets that Elon Musk and SpaceX have, are just the workhorses both for NASA and for the Department of Defense and for the intelligence community. And, you know, it's a combination of factors that he has been so successful in designing, you know, an engineering design on his rockets and the reusability of the parts of it that no one else can really match him. And, you know, Lockheed and Boeing, and they have a consortium that's called United Launch Alliance that's really struggled to get a new rocket going. It still is not ready for national security launches. So the Department of Defense in particular is really reliant upon SpaceX. And I've written about this separately in another story earlier this year, just how completely dependent the United States currently is on him. And I mean, it's not as if they're giving him contracts because of who he is. They're giving him contracts because he can reliably get the NASA satellites and Defense Department and intelligence satellites in the space.
So if you could talk about, for example, the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration opening five investigations into Tesla's safety issues, and also Tesla's ongoing legal battles with the NLRB, the National Labor Relations Board, including cases where the company tried to block rulings punishing Musk for anti-union tweets.
Right. I mean, there's so many of these investigations. I have a little cheat sheet that I kind of built as I was kind of scouring the reach of the federal government to look at all the dockets and pull together information about each of these. But yes, the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration has five different ongoing active investigations relating to things like unintended acceleration, steering wheel detachment, steering loss, and of course, most popularly, the self-driving and the fatal accident involving self-driving. And so that's just at one division of the U.S. Department of Transportation. Over next door at the FAA, they recently fined SpaceX about $600,000 based on their conclusion that SpaceX had improperly conducted two launches last year out of Florida that they were not compliant with safety requirements. So that's two divisions of DOT. There's also the transportation also was investigating. This is the Pipeline Hazardous Material Safety Administration, another division of transportation. So now it's three different agencies in the one cabinet department. Find the Neuralink, which is building implants into brains to help people, who are either disabled to see again or maybe to walk again. But Neuralink was shipping hazardous materials without a hazardous materials permit. So that was another investigation and fine. That's just one federal agencies, but it goes on and on. There's over a dozen.
Eric,
the Department of Justice.
We're going to have to leave it there, but I want to thank you for being with us. Eric Lipton, Pulitzer Prize winning journalist, investigative reporter at the New York Times, will link to you.
And very quickly, we want to again implore you to make that call that makes the difference. We are still in need of $765 to go. We can do this together, folks. We have $5 to go. We can do this together, folks. We have 1 minute to support Democracy Now! Freedom is not free. We ensure